Speaking of liberties, we have Alex Newman of LibertySentinel.org joining us, and he has just put out an excellent book about education. You've heard me on this program for years quote Alex on his, I think, perfect metaphor. As a matter of fact, it's one of the chapters that he's got here about the burning building and how the schools are like a burning building. Get your kid out of the burning building, then work with your neighbors to put the fire out before it burns down the entire neighborhood. And that's what our schools are like. And the government involvement in it that he lays out in this book goes back 200 years. It's a very meticulous, iterative process to get us where we are. So joining us now is Alex Newman. Good to talk to you again, Alex.
It is great to be here. Thank you so much, David.
Well, thanks for coming in. Let's talk a little bit about this because, you know, there's a lot of familiar names. Thomas Dewey of the Dewey Decimal System. I remember when I was in Tampa, there was a school that was named after Horace Mann as well. And I didn't at the time know who he was, but when we got into homeschooling, I learned who he was. Kind of give us an idea of how this thing has, I look at it, and when you look at the table of contents and you read the book, it makes it very clear this is a long-term plan of incremental takeover. Very much like what Antonio Gramsci said, you know, we're going to march through the institutions. You know, forget about this, you know, shooting people on the streets type of thing. It's more effective if we take over the institutions. And that's really what they've done. It's been a long march through the institution of education that has lasted over 200 years, hasn't it?
It has. It's been a tremendously powerful movement that has largely operated behind the scenes, at least in terms of their true agenda. But it does go back a couple hundred years. And I always start with before the government got involved in education, because a lot of people don't even realize there was a time when the government didn't educate our children. In fact, there was a time not all that long ago when government didn't educate our children. Parents were primarily responsible for that. And if they needed help, they'd go to the church. And at that time, we were the best educated people who had ever existed in human history at any place on the planet at any time. It was extraordinary. We had 100% literacy rates in our cities. We had 95%+ in the rural areas. Alexis de Tocqueville came here from France in the 1830s and was astounded. He said every citizen knows the history of his country, the leading features of the Constitution, the evidences and doctrines of his religion. He said everyone gets the elementary notions of human knowledge, which today, you know, we'd probably equate with a master's or a PhD. He says somebody wholly ignorant of these things is a sort of phenomenon, right? They did a study in 1812, DuPont de Nemours. Not more than 4 in 1,000 young people, he said, were unable to write legibly, even neatly. So this is where we were at before the government got involved. And then came a socialist. This was before Karl Marx had come along. This was before communism was even a thing. His name was Robert Owen. Married into a wealthy textile family, an actual socialist, right? I mean, back before this was really a thing, he believed so passionately in these silly ideas, you know, get rid of private property, live as a collective, get rid of the family, things like this, that he bought a piece of land in Indiana and started a commune called New Harmony. Very rapidly failed. The whole thing came crashing down. Not because communism is stupid, though, right? Not because getting rid of private property and the family doesn't work. It happened because these people had been educated and raised in an environment filled with Christians and individualism. So he started writing these really weird essays where he argued, actually, really for the first time that I can find since Plato, the raging totalitarian who thought we ought to have philosopher kings lording over us and they could use government schools to brainwash us all into being good submissive serfs. And so he argues that the best government would be the one that does the best job educating its population. And of course, these ideas did not take off in America. As I mentioned, we had a fabulous education non-system where everybody got a great education, mostly at home, to the extent that anybody outside the home was involved. It was typically the clergy. And he set up a secret society. I know, conspiracy here. We know about this because a whistleblower who was part of this secret society defected. He became a Catholic and repented of his involvement in this wicked plan. And he said they had two surface level goals. They wanted to change public opinion to convince Americans that education should be handled by the government, or at least that the government should have some role. And then they wanted to get men elected to legislatures who would support that concept. But the ultimate objective, this is a direct quote from Orestes Brownson, the defector who left this wicked movement. He said the ultimate objective was to get rid of Christianity, because they understood that Christianity was like a big brick wall. It was an insurmountable obstacle to their plans for utopia. So that didn't take off in America, as I mentioned, but the Prussian ambassador got a hold of these ridiculous essays that Owen was writing. And he was very popular at the time. There were, you know, Owenites, as they were called, his followers and disciples. So the Prussian ambassador gets these essays, takes them back to his master, the Prussian dictator. And of course, the Prussian dictator was still smarting from losing a war with Napoleon. You know, it wasn't going well for him. So he thought, hey, this is what we need. So he orders his interior minister to set up this government school system based on Robert Owen's ideas. According to Robert Owen's autobiography, he so much approved of this idea that he ordered this to be constructed in Prussia. First ever education system of the state, by the state, and for the state. And then from Prussia, it was re-imported into America by Horace Mann, who you mentioned. There are still, all across this country, government brainwash camps masquerading as schools named after Horace Mann. The guy was also a socialist. He was a Unitarian. He rejected the Bible. He believed the government schools should equalize all men. He wanted the Bible out of the schools under the guise of getting rid of sectarianism, which, you know, we need to understand the Bible was the primary textbook in those days. Trying to think of education without the Bible in the early mid 1800s was like an oxymoron. How could you possibly do that? So that didn't go over well. But he imports the system into Massachusetts. Right away, the dumbing down takes off, the quackery takes over, and then he travels across the country like this ridiculous evangelist, preaching the good news of salvation by government schools. Like, we're going to get rid of 90% of the crimes, and it's just going to be a wonderful utopia. And so he gets this system in place in state after state, so that by the early 1900s, every state now has intruded somewhat, at least, into education. Some have set up, you know, networks of government schools. And then World War I, big turning point. That's when, for the first time in American history, most American children are in government schools. And that's when John Dewey bursts on the scene. He had been writing and rambling about education for a long time. He actually went to the Soviet Union and just loved what they were doing. This is so incredible. He wrote about it, too, David. This is incredible. Everybody who goes to a government college to learn education will learn that John Dewey is this hero, you know, the architect of America's wonderful progressive education system. They won't learn about his essays about the Soviet Union, about what a great city. They were published in the New Republic. They're still in their archives. And so he wanted that in America. And very interestingly, he teams up with the Rockefellers to fund this. So you've got, it sounds like a bad joke, right? A super capitalist and a communist walk into a bar and they decide, hey, let's dumb down the population by setting up a government school system. But it's the truth. And so that's kind of the genesis of this. And it's been getting worse with every generation, moving toward this goal of a dumbed down, fully indoctrinated population that will give up its liberties, turn against God, turn against the family, turn against the country, and you know, revolution by other means, if you will.
It's fascinating. And I had an example. I've talked about this in the past. When I was in Raleigh, there was a counselor there before the Soviet Union fell, and she went to Moscow. She came back. She said, you can go anywhere you want to in Moscow for a nickel. We need that here in Raleigh. And it's like, it's this woman smoking. I mean, it sounds like just like Dewey. But yeah, it is interesting, isn't it, how you see these so-called capitalists teaming with the communists to run this kind of stuff through. You were talking about how in the early days of America, the literacy rate was so high. And of course, we know that because look at the impact that Thomas Paine's Common Sense had on people, right? It had a big impact because everybody read and they were able to comprehend what they read as well. And so it really was a system where people didn't spend 18 years to get a little bit of understanding and to be miseducated. I think today what we've seen is that this is all about social engineering. And of course, you break that down in your book, just like you broke down the history of this, how it went from socialism to the people who embraced Marxism. I mean, Owen was out there even before Karl Marx was out there, wasn't he?
That's right. Yep. And promoting really similar ideas to what Karl Marx would come along and promote a few decades later.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people, when they think of where did the government schools come from, the first one they can think of is Karl Marx. Because he, of course, proposed in the Communist Manifesto in the 10 Planks that government should control the education of all children. They should be free in so-called public schools. But really, Robert Owen deserves the real credit for kicking this movement off, of course, with a major assist from the dictator in Prussia. Now, I cannot yet, I'm still looking, I cannot yet conclusively connect Horace Mann to Robert Owen's secret network, right? Mm-hmm. What the whistleblower described as a secret society based, incidentally, on the Carbonari, right? This nasty, vile group headquartered in Italy. So I can't connect them definitively yet. I suspect there is a link there beyond just, you know, went to Prussia and then Horace Mann imported it back. But I can't prove it yet. By nature, secret societies are difficult to track. But it's so interesting how every one of the critical men in creating the system that today we call the public school rejected God, rejected the principles that America was based on, and had this utopian vision involving really what Karl Marx called for, eliminating private property, eliminating nations, eliminating family, and moving toward this alleged brotherhood of man.
Yeah. Yeah. They see themselves as God. And so they don't want any of that competition that's out there. They want to be, especially today, omnipresent and omniscient about everything that we're doing everywhere that we are, the Big Brother move. You know, when we talk about the Prussian involvement, and we see that in things like kindergarten, right? This whole idea that we got to get the kids very early, as you pointed out, going back to Plato, he was talking about that. You know, we want them to see the state as their family and don't even want them to know who their parents are. We will raise them from a very early age. Everybody understands that. Totalitarian dictators have understood that. Of course, the Bible warns us about that as well. You know, you get these kids when they're young and you train them, they're not going to depart from that. And the dictators know that as well. And so it's a real battle to try to get the kids at the earliest possible age, isn't it?
It is. And Robert Owen, that was one of the things he pioneered even before setting up this ridiculous commune. He had this textile manufacturing operation on the British Isles that he had married into. Again, he married into a wealthy textile family. And one of the social experiments that he tried there was getting these young mothers to come work in the factory and promising to take care of their babies, right? So they were getting 2-3-year-old kids in these social engineering centers. This is like really the pioneering effort to do this. And you said something else, David, that I really want to pick up on because it's so critical for people to understand as they see themselves as gods. So John Dewey wasn't just a communist in the traditional sense of the term. Now, in his defense, he did reject violent revolution. He believed that slowly brainwashing the population over a period of generations would be a better way to achieve total power. So in his defense. But one of the things that he did, one of the things that he's best known for, other than his education blabbering, was something called the Humanist Manifesto. So John Dewey and 30-something of his buddies, members of the clergy, Unitarian clergy, academics, philosophers, and other leaders came together and they wrote what they called the Humanist Manifesto. Today we call it the Humanist Manifesto 1 because their disciples have released new and improved versions. But right at the very beginning of this document, and this was their religion, and they again, in their defense, they were open and transparent about the fact that this was their religion. Don't know where they found enough faith to believe some of these idiotic things, but you know, it's a free country, you can believe whatever you want. So the very first tenet of their false religion was religious humanists regard the universe as self-existing and not created. Well, you know, you can compare and contrast that with the word of God, Genesis 1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. You can contrast that with our Declaration of Independence, right? The self-evident truth that God created us, God endowed us with unalienable rights, God made us equal, etc. And so clearly they're telling you our religion is fundamentally at odds at a most basic level with the Bible and with the principles that America was founded on, which largely came from the Bible, despite being called self-evident truth. So there we have something really critical. Now, as you read through the rest of this religion, it's kind of just warmed over Karl Marx. You know, we've got to, I think they said that we need equitable distribution of the means of life, which is another way of saying abolish private property and have the government control the means of production. So we've got to institute a radical change in methods and motives. We've got to get rid of the profit motive as the organizing principle for the economy. So it was communism, but there was a really, really critical undertone that it wasn't stated explicitly. If there is no real God, that just leaves us as gods. That's right. It will be you and I who determine what is right and wrong. You and I who determine what rights or privileges you may have. And I tell people, like, they thought they invented a new religion. They pretended like they were inventing a new religion. This is literally the oldest lie in the book. If you go back to Genesis chapter 3, you've got Satan saying that very same thing. Ye shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. So this really was a false religion from the pit of hell. And this was one of the reasons why John Dewey was so obsessed with the schools. One of the guys who co-signed this Humanist Manifesto, his name was C.F. Potter. He wrote a book called Humanism, A New Religion. And in this book, he brags. He says, you know, we're going to use the public schools as the greatest ally of humanism. And he kind of laughs, like, what is your Sunday school, your theistic Sunday school going to do teaching some of the children for 1 hour a week when we have them for 5 days of humanistic teachings? He didn't even answer. I think the answer was obvious. Absolutely nothing. So along comes the Supreme Court in 1962. They say you can't have prayer in the schools anymore. And you know, by the way, this was a non-sectarian prayer. It was a Catholic priest, a Protestant minister, and a Jewish rabbi came together and wrote a prayer like, "Hey God, please bless our school, bless our family, bless our parents, bless our country, bless our teachers. Amen." And so the Supreme Court said, no, First Amendment, you can't have that, because apparently the state of New York is Congress. Wait, no, that's how dumbed down we were that people bought into this. 1963 comes along. They ban the Bible in school. Again, they cite the First Amendment. And the guy who wrote the dissent in this case, Justice Potter Stewart, I encourage people to read this dissent. It is beautiful. It's wonderful. It should be required reading for everybody interested in education and everybody interested in constitutional law. He says, what we have done here is not neutrality with respect to religion. What we've done here, he says, is establish the religion of secularism, or what John Dewey would have called humanism. Yes. Under the guise of preventing Congress from establishing a religion, the Supreme Court established a false religion, forced us to pay for its propagation with our taxes, and forced our children to be brainwashed with this false religion. So we're full circle. You're right. They think they're gods.
You know, we used to go frequently when we lived in North Carolina. We used to go to Colonial Williamsburg. And they had a very good guy there who did a good job of impersonating Thomas Jefferson. And he would take questions. And of course, I knew he wasn't going to respond anything that was contemporary, anything that was going to be political, you know. But I would throw it out there to kind of speak to the audience. And every time I was there, I would always ask him a question. I say, you know, you said that you stood up very much for freedom, free exercise of religion, and not having an official state religion. You said it was an abomination for people to have to be forced to attend a church, and it was also an abomination for people to have to be forced to pay for something that they disagreed with. And I said, but then you also set up the state university there. Would you admit that perhaps a government education system is no different from an enforced government education system, which is what you just pointed out? It is. You know, and so that's why I was trying to get people to understand. You understand that we're right back to having an established religion. It's just that the seminaries are the colleges and the places where they indoctrinate everybody on a daily basis are these government schools. And you're forced to pay for it. We're at the point right now where they were at some of these early colonies, over a period of time, they transitioned away from it. At first, everybody had to attend the official state church and pay money to it. Then they said, well, you don't have to attend, but you still got to pay for it. That's where we are right now with homeschooling. You don't have to attend this state religion they call government schools, but we still got to pay for it, don't we?
That's exactly right. And you know, the Bible actually teaches this. Early Americans would have recognized, I think, pretty quickly what's happening here. Jesus is quoted twice in the Gospels. In Matthew and in Luke, he says, whoever's not with me is against me. Mm-hmm. Right? And so I encourage people to think about this for a minute. Are the government schools with Christ? Well, and if the answer is no, and it obviously is no, no Christian or anti-Christian would even deny that at this point, then that leaves one option. They are anti-Christian. And to your point, you know, the Bible teaches Proverbs 22:6, train up a child in the way he should go, but he's old, he will not depart from it. In Luke, Jesus is quoted saying that students are not greater than their teachers. When they're fully trained, they're going to be like their teachers. And so we have a system here that was designed to instill a worldview in your children. It was designed to handicap them, literally. Yeah. Right? And we can get into that. There's a reason why half of American adults are functionally illiterate. And when you put all that together, you realize this is a profoundly religious exercise. It may not be a religion that an average person would recognize, but it is religious. And in fact, I think education is inseparable from discipleship. The question is, who is doing the discipling? That's right. Is it parents? Is it pastors from an official religion? Or is it a school that doesn't tell you it's a religion, but is still instilling very religious concepts in it? I mean, all of the fundamental presuppositions that underpin the worldview taught in the public schools today are profoundly religious, and it takes an enormous amount of faith to agree with them, right? The idea, for example, that everything came from nothing. I mean, that contradicts everything we know about physics. It contradicts the most basic tenets of common sense, and yet that is the underlying philosophy that underpins virtually everything that is being instilled in these children as far as the worldview goes. How can it be that we can accept this tenet of faith being taught to children, but not stop and say, wait a minute, this is a profoundly religious exercise? So we need to understand that this is not a secular school system. This is a religious school system masquerading as a neutral school system.
That's very true. Do you talk about R.L. Dabney in your book? Because I remember he was a chaplain It's actually Stonewall Jackson's chaplain. And after the war, he blamed the Civil War. He said he thought it had its roots in the government school systems drawn about in Massachusetts, where it was first established. But he wrote essays saying, and very, very prescient about where we were going to be. And it, you know, not even a century, well, about a century later, that's when the Supreme Court started doing that. But he said, there's absolutely no way that you can have government involvement in education without violating the free exercise of religion, without establishing a religion. He goes, it's only a question of which religion is going to be established. You can't have neutrality and have the government funding it. You can't have the government involved in any way in education, or it is going to be establishing a politicized religion. And he was talking about that in the 1860s.
Yeah. So I don't mention him in the book, but he was absolutely correct. And one of the things that's interesting is that actually the southern states were the last holdouts when it came to government schools. They resisted mm-hmm. until the bitter end. It wasn't until Reconstruction that the northerners forced these institutions on the South. But, you know, to your point, I just had a piece published in Newsweek just about a week or two ago, and I quoted two modern scholars, and, you know, people can think whatever they want about these two guys. One is former U.S. Attorney General Bill Barr. And, you know, I've got my obvious concerns with his background and all the rest of it. But what he said in a 2021 speech, he said this militant and extreme secular progressive climate of our state-run education system is the greatest threat to religious liberty in America today. And of course, he is correct. I also quoted a Columbia Law professor, Philip Hamburger, arguing that public schools, by definition, violate the First Amendment rights of parents. And that's because they force parents, or at least very strongly pressure them, into substituting their own speech, right? What parents would tell their own children for what the state wants to tell their children. Mm-hmm. And so this is an infringement on our religious liberty. This is an infringement on our freedom of speech. It's an infringement on our parental rights. It's an infringement on our property rights, that they're extorting us for thousands of dollars every year on our property to be able to pay for these brainwash camps to hurt our children. So this is a fundamental violation of every tenet of a truly free society. And yet today we're supposed to think of it as American as apple pie. It's not. It's wicked. Frankly, you know, when people ask me how to reform it, I say, why would you want to reform it? It's like asking me how I want to reform my cancer. I'll pass, thank you. I want to get rid of the cancer. And it's not because I'm anti-education. It's because I'm pro-education.
That's right. That's right. But they have inextricably linked education and schools in people's minds. And they're two different things. We're talking about an institution versus, you know, something that you actually have. The education is something you have, but you don't need to have the school system. That's, as you're pointing out, we've seen the way this evolves. You pointed out in your book. Let's talk a little bit about the Frankfurt School and its effect on education. Mostly we talk about the Frankfurt School and its effect on Hollywood and entertainment and media and stuff, but talk about its effect on education.
Yeah, so the Frankfurt School, once again, we intersect with John Dewey, right? So he had set up this experimental school at the University of Chicago, and funded by the Rockefellers. They gave him $3.1 million through the General Education Board, one of their early philanthropic efforts, if you want to call it that. Frederick Gates, the guy they put in charge of it, was a total megalomaniac. He bragged about how, you know, in our perfect world, these people will yield themselves with perfect docility to our benevolent molding hand. You know, all this gobbledygook. So eventually, once they come up with this formula that they really like, so John Dewey's experimental school graduated a bunch of kids who couldn't read, couldn't write, couldn't do math, couldn't tell right from wrong. And so they loved this idea. So John Dewey then goes over to Columbia University. And at Columbia University, starts bringing in a bunch of these progressives. Now, the Frankfurt School is happening over in Frankfurt. So the Frankfurt School, the Institute for Social Research at the University of Frankfurt, Goethe, they had actually been a project of the Comintern, the Communist Internationale.
This is in Germany for people. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Right. In Frankfurt, Germany. And so they actually, this idea was hatched by the Comintern. They came to the same conclusion as Gramsci, although they would never admit it publicly. But Marx was wrong. Right. Marx was wrong. He thought it was inevitable that the working class was going to rise up in a revolution. And, you know, they finally, after 60 years of realizing that wasn't going to happen, said, OK, fine, it's not going to happen. We've got to do something different. And so Gramsci and the Comintern, through the Frankfurt School, concluded, hey, we've got to break down these cultural barriers to revolution. We've got to attack the family. We've got to attack the church. We've got to attack the values. We've got to attack patriotism. So they went after the institutions, the values, the attitudes that they understood were blocking revolution. And so that really was where the Frankfurt School came in. Now, I want to be clear, because sometimes people say, well, if you don't like the Frankfurt School, you must be pro-Nazi. No, no. The Nazis and the communists were very, very close cousins. In fact, the New York Times reported before the outbreak of World War II that the Nazis, the Hitlerites, actually regarded Vladimir Lenin as the second greatest man in the world, second only to Adolf Hitler. So really, they're very, very close beliefs. I mean, they had some differences on, you know, racial issues and stuff, but they were all in favor of the state Uber Alles. They were all in favor of genocide against, you know, Marx actually advocated genocide against the groups that hadn't reached the capitalist stage. Because, you know, he just thought they were too backwards to do anything with. So they had a lot in common. But eventually, the Frankfurt School, the socialists, the communists there had a falling out with the National Socialists. And so they had to flee Germany. And John Dewey, with Rockefeller money, brought them to Columbia University. And then from there, they spread out across our country like a cancer, University of California, et cetera. And they started promoting these incredibly subversive doctrines under the guise of academia, right? They all got set up in universities. A lot of them actually went into the education field to educate educators. And they came up with these very subversive ideas, like, for example, the idea of the authoritarian male. So dads and husbands in America were basically fascists, right? They were lording it over their wives and children. And of course, they understood dads and husbands were critical to protecting their families from this tide of wickedness. And so they figured, if we can emasculate the dads and the husbands, the fathers, the patriarchs, it'll be a lot easier to steamroller over this society. So they spread this notion through the colleges, through the schools of education, that the American father was somehow a totalitarian, that he needed to be stopped. They spread the idea of perversion and filth being in every element of our culture. So they spread all these evil doctrines. And again, education was one of the primary fields they went into. So this was a critical component of hijacking the then existing government school system, weaponizing it further, again, with money from the big foundations, and turning it into the most effective tool for revolution, really, I think, ever conceived in human history.
You know, it's interesting to see, as you lay this out, I think about what we've got in terms of these institutions. I think about, you know, the building of a building and how long it takes to lay the foundation. And then all of a sudden, after the foundation is there, boom, you know, the stick walls go up. You know, when you got the framing going up, it goes up very, very quickly. And that's really what we see. We see this foundation being laid over a very long period of time. And then you have the stages where it goes through in spurts, and a lot of stuff happens all at once. And we're in, I think, the final stage of this stuff now, as we see everything changing incredibly rapidly. I guess maybe we're in the stage where they're decorating and painting things with a drag queen. I don't know. Maybe that's where we torture this analogy here to that point. But, you know, people are looking at this stuff now. We got a good shot at this during the lockdown. People were able to see on Zoom what was actually happening in their kids' class. But it's just amazing how rapidly this has changed. But I've seen all of this stuff throughout my lifetime. You know, I began school before you had the Supreme Court decisions saying that you got to purge God out of the schools. And it was even the government schools. And it took a while for them to implement that. So I was in that system for a few years and gradually saw this kind of stuff change. And I've had like a front row seat of this dumbing down and degeneracy that is going on in the school system all of my life. And it truly is amazing to see that. And I think it's very important. That's the real importance, I think, of your book, is for people to get that sense of history, to see how this was done iteratively, to see how these foundations were laid over a very long period of time. Talk a little bit about, the something that's a little bit more recent, but still several decades back, and that's Common Core. And of course, we had the Republicans heavily involved in that as well.
We did. And, you know, Common Core, I think, is misunderstood by even most of the people who follow closely education. Yes, it dumbed down the population. We know that. It's objectively provable. The federal government actually hired a group, CSAIL, to do a study on this. And 7 years into it, they said, whoa, the negative effects of this are just wild. We don't even know where the bottom is because we haven't hit it yet. We're still going down. So terrible from an academic perspective. In fact, they put two subject matter experts, and only two subject matter experts on the Common Core Validation Committee. This was the hand-picked committee that was supposed to rubber stamp these things and say they were great. Both of them refused to sign off. The math expert, Dr. James Milgram of Stanford, said some of this is based on incorrect math. Like, no, I'm not signing off on this garbage. The English expert, Dr. Sandra Stosky, I know her. I serve on a board with her. Very nice lady. She said, look, this is going to reduce the critical thinking abilities in children. You're taking out good literature and you're replacing it with like Obama's executive orders and EPA regulations on roof insulation. No, I'm not signing off on this. So both the subject matter experts said no. The federal government knows it's making your kids dumber. And a lot of people look at it as the nationalization of education. And yes, it was. That was a process that started decades earlier. In fact, the George H.W. New World Order administration had really, really put the pedal to the metal on nationalizing the school system just very shortly after the birth of the U.S. Department of Education. But really, what Common Core was, even more significant than those two other things, which I don't want to downplay the significance of those, it was the globalization of education. And that's what people don't realize. Okay, so Bill Gates of hell went over to UNESCO headquarters in 2004, and he signed an agreement with UNESCO. UNESCO, for those who aren't familiar, is the UN's education agency. It's the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. And so Bill Gates signed this deal with them back in 2004. I've got a copy of the deal. He signed on behalf of Microsoft. They vowed that they were going to work closely together on creating global education standards, global curricula, global teacher training programs, and global technology systems to make sure it was all being implemented properly. Well, he comes back to the United States and starts dumping millions of dollars. And then by the time it's all said and done, $2.3 billion into this project called Common Core. Most of the funding, of course, came from taxpayers, but Bill Gates provided the genesis there, just starting the ball rolling. And they actually bought ads. I've got some of these ads. I play them when I go out and do talks on this, where they're bragging that Common Core state standards are actually going to align American education with international standards. They're saying this proudly. They bought ads to tell this to the American people. And so let's go back a little bit more in time. Prior to 2004, the UN had concocted what they call the World Core Curriculum. And the guy who wrote it, Robert Mueller, he was the Assistant Secretary General of the UN, one step below the actual Secretary General. He says this needs to be taught to every child in every school on planet Earth. I've got a lot of these documents. I've got a lot of these materials in my office. And in the foreword to the teacher's manual, he says something astounding, David. And I think this is really the most critical thing to understand about what's happening on the educational front today. In the foreword, he says this is based on the teachings of Alice Bailey and the Tibetan teacher Jeval Kul. And, you know, it's very easy to read right over that. Well, Alice Bailey, I've got her books here, right? Here's her book, Education in the New Age. She was the founder of the Lucifer Publishing Company. Literally, that was the name of the organization. It's still around today. It's called the Lucius Trust. And the Tibetan teacher was actually a spiritual entity that Alice Bailey claimed to be communicating with. She called it an ascended master. And so channeling these demons, she wrote books like Education in the New Age. And people can read this. It's absolutely bonkers. I mean, you almost can't believe it until you read it yourself. We need a one world government. We need a one world brain. The government school system is going to unite humanity into this global society where we're going to evolve to a new age of consciousness. And you know, the only problem that she says is these people who insist on this great heresy of separateness, which also known as Bible believing Christians, who are told to be holy and to not participate in these wicked things of the world. So Christians are the obstacle to this one world utopia on whom the global World Core curriculum is based. So wow, that's what's happening here, folks. The schools are preparing your children for submission to an all-powerful one world dictatorship based on the rantings of crazy woman and her demons.
Yeah, yeah, her ascended masters. And of course, yes, we keep seeing this stuff about ascended masters keep reweaving itself everywhere. You know, even when we break off, we got a conservative group, we got like Michael Flynn leading prayers to an ascended master that he verbatim from Elizabeth Clare Prophet, you know, the reawakened stuff. So you constantly have this occultic ascended master stuff weaving itself back in, even in, you know, they call themselves conservatives, even in those circles, it's always there. It always finds a way back in. It truly is amazing. When we look
David,
at
yeah. Yeah, David, can I stop you there for just one moment?
Sure.
Because I want to pick up on this ascended master theme, especially since you seem to be interested in it. So even before the World Core curriculum. Actually, George H.W. Bush had hired a lady. This is the New World Order guy, right? Who said we're going to have a credible United Nations, going to use a peacekeeping role to implement the vision of the UN's founders. So he hires a lady for the U.S. Department of Education named Dr. Shirley McCoon. And surprise, she's also talking to ascended masters. The true story, she wrote a book with one of her buddies called The Light Shall Set You Free. Same general idea, right? The ascended mm-hmm. masters told me we gotta, you know, evolve to this new higher consciousness state. So she's the lady that they put at the Department of Education to start leading the charge for the national testing, the national accountability, ultimately the national standards. And she gives a speech to the 50 governors. George H.W. Bush convened all 50 governors together. And she gives a speech. I've got a copy of the speech. I've got the video. And she says to them, look, the schools, you know, the real purpose of schools is, she said, transforming society. She says, we're fundamentally restructuring society. And we have to understand that the social change function of schools is what's going to get us there. Right. And now fast forward to more recent times. You've probably heard of social emotional learning. In fact, I have a chapter on this in the book.
SEL. And people SEL, typically see it as SEL. Yeah.
And the NEA, the National Education Association, says now this is the most important function of schools. And it's in all the schools, even in some Christian schools, by the way. And so I started investigating this years ago before people had done any real critical research on this. And they still had all the documents publicly available. So I went to CASEL. This is an organization funded by Bill Gates. It's the premier SEL organization. It's called the Collaborative for Academic Social Emotional Learning. And right there, they had a history tab on their website. So I click on the history tab. And right there, in plain English, it says the idea for SEL came out of conversations that we had at the Fetzer Institute. Huh. What is the Fetzer Institute? I had never heard of the Fetzer Institute. So I look it up real quick. Turns out it's a new age, occult, bizarre place founded by some crazy rich guy, a disciple of Alice Bailey. And they're doing these invocations to the ascended masters and all. This theme of the occult, this theme of the ascended masters bringing us into the new age runs through this entire program. And yet your average Christian has no idea. 80% of Christians in this country are still sending their children to these pagan, godless, diabolical indoctrination centers. And you just want to shake them, like, wake up, you fool. Yeah. What's happening to your children? Don't you care?
Yeah, absolutely. And you talk about the fact that even private schools are going to have SEL there. And a big part of this is one of the things that concerns me about charter schools, about private schools. Whenever you take the government's money, then they're going to start telling you what you've got to do, even if it means putting boys in the girls' showers and that type of stuff, which takes us back to the Department of Education. And I believe, what do you think about the department? I think its primary function was there to bribe and to blackmail people to get these things through, because that is such a powerful superpower that the federal government has, where it can just create money out of thin air, and then they can channel it through the Department of Education, and they can use that to take over charter schools or private schools or anybody who takes the government coin. We even see, especially in colleges. I mean, look at how they've been able to control colleges through the power of the purse and the money. And that's the way the federal government operates most of the time. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And that's why they set up the Department of Education. I quote William Zoster in the book. He was former leader of the Communist Party here in the United States. And he wrote a book called Toward a Soviet America. This was 100 years ago. He says, one of our key objectives is to establish a national Department of Education that's going to be used to cleanse all the schools of everything that might be considered religious or patriotic or bourgeois. We're going to turn them into institutions of revolution. And actually, that goes back to, we started off the conversation with Robert Owen, the whistleblower I mentioned, Orestes Brownson, when he's exposing this whole agenda, why they're doing this. He says the great object is to get rid of Christianity. And what he says is our goal was to get a system of state and then national education so that we could then bring religion into contempt. So that was the goal from the very beginning. The totalitarians, the anti-God fanatics wanted a national system where they could then much more simply control all education in this country. And now this is actually being bumped up to the global level. So Arne Duncan, who spent 7 years as Secretary of Miseducation under Barack Obama, this guy was bragging about how UNESCO is the partner of the U.S. Department of Education with the implementing global education initiatives. So that all he quoted a communist terrorist. He said, education is a weapon that we're going to use to change the world. So they're telling you all this. I mean, you don't have to listen to David Knight and Alex Newman. These people will tell you what they're doing if you'll just listen. You won't see it on Fox News. You won't see it on CNN or on the front page of your local propaganda organ owned by the USA Today or whatever. But these people are telling you what they're doing if you'll just listen.
And of course, it's not something that the politicians are going to talk about either. You know, it was at least in 1980, and it was created in a campaign year by Carter, and Reagan said he's going to get rid of it. But of course, he didn't. And he had people like Charlotte Disraby and Phyllis Schlafly who went there to help shut that thing down, and they left in disgust. Charlotte Disraby said it's the deliberate dumbing down of America, and it truly is. That's what it's about. But it's gotten beyond that now. It's not just dumbing us down. It's pushing us down into degeneracy. You know, when you look at, and you got chapters, of course, on critical race theory, but also one of the chapters, totalitarian agenda behind the LGBT sex ed. Yeah, I've looked at this for a long. The transgender stuff is obviously sexual component to it, a grooming that is there. But as we start to see this other stuff and the furries and this complete detachment from reality, starts me to believe that they're moving us into that other branch of secularism, transhumanism, preparing kids to live in this, to be completely incapable of operating in the real world, not wanting to be in the real world, but also to push them into a virtual reality, which they're already doing in the schools. I can't believe that in the schools they let the kids dress this way, have things, paws that have claws on them that they can scratch people with. I mean, that is the absolute breakdown of any kind of discipline. But you have to ask yourself, what is their agenda? And as you can see in your book, it is a very clear agenda. It is a very clear goal of all this stuff. It's all converging on this and marching progressively forward. Talk a little bit about that, but I do want to spend some time in terms of talking about the positive vision. You know, it's very important for people to understand how the school is really on fire. A lot of people don't realize it's on fire. They don't realize that it was a deliberately set fire, and they don't see the implications of it for society, for the neighborhood in general. And that's what your book really does lay out. But I want to talk a little bit about positive vision. But talk a little bit about what is going on with this LGBT thing. I mean, it's a sexual component, but I think it's also got something to do with this transhumanism and high tech and virtual reality, even though we're talking about costume characters at this point. What do you think?
You are absolutely right, David. There's no question about it. And so there's actually multiple agendas, but let's talk on the two that you just hit on, and they're both discussed extensively in the book. The first is, you know, the LGBT thing. I think one of the major reasons they're pushing this is actually to take down the family unit. And if you go back and you look at the history of sex education, Wilhelm Reich, 100 years ago, described himself as a Freudo-Marxist. Member of the Communist Party, and he said, we've got to get the sex ed in the schools so that we can turn children away from their families, so we can undermine their credibility, we can undermine the influence of the church, and basically grab hold of the minds and hearts of these children and write on a blank slate. That was why they did it. You look at Georgi Lukacs, the deputy commissar of education and culture in the Béla Kun communist regime in Hungary, short-lived communist dictatorship. He ended up going to become part of the Frankfurt School, incidentally. He was doing these nasty, raunchy puppet shows in front of kindergarten kids for the purpose of breaking down the Christian moral order. And he said so, right? Yeah. So you look now at the modern iteration of this. First, they told us, just loving homosexuals, just want to be married, you know, just quit being such a prude. And people say, well, don't kids need a mom and a dad? Well, you know, it's better to have two dads than no dads, right? Or it's better to have two moms than no moms, right? Yeah. So they started off by saying, well, it's really not that important to have both a mom and a dad, which, of course, anybody with two brain cells to rub together knows is ridiculous, right? Yes, you can survive. You might become a great human being even without one of those. But the optimal condition, the divine order that God has established, is for a child to be raised by a mother and a father, a loving marriage relationship. Well, they figured, hey, if we can get the mom or the dad out of the picture by marketing this homosexual marriage and homosexual adoption, that's a good first step. Now you come to the next step, the transgenderism. Well, now they're saying there's no such thing as a mom or dad, right? The gender is a social construct. You could be any. I'm a non-binary, you're a non-binary, I'm a free spirit, whatever. So now they're saying not only is a mom or a dad not essential, now they're saying there's no such thing as a mom or dad. So you can see this is a calculated assault on the nuclear family so that the state ultimately can usurp control over the raising, education, discipling of these children. Now, the transhumanism element is just as significant. They're telling these kids right now, you can transcend your, they call it sex assigned at birth, really your sex, right? You can transcend, but if you can transcend your sex, you might be a boy born in a girl's body. Well, why in the world shouldn't you be able to transcend your humanity altogether? Why shouldn't you be a cat? Why shouldn't you be an elephant? And and so this converges with the technology in a very, very evil and dark way, David. I've got a section in the book on the first conference on AI and education hosted by the UN in Beijing, of all places. And they openly said in their final declaration, we're going to fuse artificial intelligence with education. We're going to connect these kids to the system, and we are going to use this to manipulate and ultimately change their attitudes, values, beliefs, and behaviors. This is what they said in the final document. Wow. So that's where they're moving. In China now, in a lot of schools, they're using these headbands that monitor the children's brainwaves and feed this information into a computer so that it can be processed by the algorithms and the AI to determine whether the child's paying attention, etc. Now, with Neuralink, folks, you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to project the lines here and see where this is going. It is dark. It is wicked. Bill Gates actually predicted just last year, I believe, that soon we'd be able to replace teachers with AI. That's what's happening. Teachers are going to become glorified babysitters. The kids are going to sit there on their tablets and eventually with those, you know, stupid goggles on their face, learning all about, you know, how great open borders are, abortions, etc. There's no education going on here anymore, and the sooner parents realize that, the better.
Oh yeah, I want to replace Bill Gates. That's what I want to replace.
We could get a nice AI who's not quite as wicked.
Yeah, anything would not be quite as wicked as him.
He's out there. Plant would be perfect.
Yeah, exactly. He's out there, you know, pushing against math now. I mean, he really is going the full two plus two equals five stuff. But yeah, it truly is a war on parents, especially as you pointed out. You just think about the fact that you must use these pronouns, but you must not say mother and father, right? Or mom and dad or whatever. There's that kind of mind control that we see out there. And it really does go back again to the UN and to the children's rights movement that was there, the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. If they can say that children have rights, then that's their legal way of shoving parents out. And so even though we didn't sign on to that treaty ever, the only country that didn't, they are still enforcing this through the courts, enforcing it through the schools and all the rest of that. But let's talk a little bit about homeschooling. Because it is an amazing opportunity. You know, God has left us this open door for us to have a family, for us to have a relationship with children, for us to actually be able to educate our kids about the things of this world, as well as about God. And that is a very, very important window that is there. And it's never been more open. Since after the lockdown, people are open to it. They're looking at it. And there's so many more resources. And we homeschooled our kids. It truly is blossoming there. And there's an opportunity for anybody who wants to do it. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I do regard homeschooling as the gold standard. If anybody is capable of doing it, and I believe almost everybody is capable of doing it, I cannot recommend it highly enough. It's one of the best decisions you will make in your entire life. Also, one of the most important decisions you will make in your life. So I go back to, you know, the Bible in Deuteronomy chapter 6, Deuteronomy chapter 11. You have God explaining to his people how they ought to be educating their children. He says, you need to be teaching them about God and God's laws and God's ways and what he has done for us. When you wake up in the morning, when you're walking by the way, when you're sitting down to eat, when you're laying down to go to bed at night, at all times, you should be educating your children. Mm-hmm. And I think the most fundamental part to understand, and I do believe, you know, we have freedom. We can delegate some of that responsibility and authority to others, whether it be a homeschool co-op, a Christian school that is thoroughly vetted and well examined. But with that said, I do believe homeschooling is the gold standard. I believe it's the best possible thing that you can do. Always doing it with community, right? Getting together with other families, getting together through your church and having fun with it. But I think ultimately we need to get back to a real understanding of what education is. And this is one of the things that the system has caused us to lose. What is the purpose of education is a fundamental question that people don't even ask themselves anymore. what do I mean when I say I want my child to be educated? Now, if you ask Google, which tells you men can get pregnant, Google will say the purpose of education, true story, they say the purpose of education is to make your children successful members of society. I asked a couple AIs, they said the same thing. They cited the Washington Compost as a source. So the purpose of education then is either college and career readiness or making your child successful, whatever. Is that really the purpose of education? And I would argue, absolutely not. That's not even, you know, third or fourth down the line. And what does it mean, like, in a Nazi society or a communist society to be a successful member? Does that mean you're good at snitching on your neighbors? Does that mean you're good at guarding the concentration camp and torturing political prisoners? It's absolutely crazy. So I say we need to go back to the Word of God to understand truly what an education is. And you know, God gives us, again, a lot of freedom here. He doesn't say you need 25 credit hours of science and 32 of math, but he does give us the foundations. Yeah. Right? Proverbs 1:7, Proverbs 9:10 says the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. It's the beginning of knowledge. So if the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, and there is absolutely no fear of the Lord being instilled in our children in virtually any educational setting with a handful of exceptions in this country, how much wisdom and knowledge are they getting? Well, the answer is none, right? Yeah. Absolutely none. At best, it's counterfeit. So we've got to go back and ask ourselves the fundamental questions. I actually end the book with a very, very long afterword. Maybe would have been better to divide up as several chapters, but looking at, you know, what did education look like before the government took it over? What does the Bible say about education? What are some resources out there for parents who are thinking about these questions? And I believe this is one of the most important things we could be thinking about and talking about, David.
Oh, absolutely. And just as you said earlier, when you're talking about a family, you said a two-parent, that would be ideal, and that's the goal. But hey, you know, we still need to be a parent, even if there's just one of us. And when you look at homeschooling, you can say, well, I would like to do classical homeschooling. Oh, that'd be great, but that's really a lot. I don't know if I could do that. Well, you don't necessarily have to do that. You know, you can aim for certain things. If you don't have two parents in your family, there are other ways that you can do that, especially now there are so many more resources, so many more people who are looking to partner in community to help to do this. And so there's a lot of resources that are out there. And sometimes we look at this and say, well, I can't do the ideal, so I won't even get started. But what I have found is that if you do this with the purpose of honoring God, God has always promised us that he will honor those who honor him. And there, it's an amazing blessing. Everybody that I know, and I know a lot of people now since I'm older who have homeschooled their kids, and everybody that did it, they are so blessed by the relationship that they have with their kids and have no regrets whatsoever about it. It's one of the best things you can do with your life. And when you're looking at society, you know, this whole thing about the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. Well, these people who want to rule the world have been rocking the cradle, and we need to get their hands off of our cradles because they've rocked our world, and they've rocked it in a very negative way, and we need to take back control of the cradle, and we need to take back control of our kids. And I think that whatever you can do is a move in the right direction. You know, we did a very informal homeschooling curriculum with our kids, but you know, we were there with them, and we talked to them in the way, as we're in the way, so to speak. And so it was kind of a peripatetic form of instruction, but there's so many different ways that you can do it. And it is an amazing blessing to have that relationship with your kids. One of the best relationships you could ever have in life. And the best way to have that relationship, I think, is to work with your kids. I'm so glad that you did this book. And again, you understand that. You, you know, like you said, you've got a very long afterword toward a Christian vision of education, and what did we have, and what could we have again? That's up to each and every one of us. You know, we don't have to get the permission of Trump or Biden to educate our kids, ever. You know, even if they try to impose that on us, we can still do it ourselves. And so that should be our attitude, that we're not going to do it. But right now, we have this amazing opportunity. I said to my wife 30 years ago when we started this whole process, I said, you know, isn't it interesting how we've lost freedom in every aspect of our society except when it comes to education? And somehow God has left that door open, hasn't he?
Absolutely. And it's such a joy. You know, I would warn people that the totalitarians are coming for us. So we've got to stand firm. This is a non-negotiable issue. You will not have my children, and that's a line that will not be crossed. And every parent needs to make that determination. We will not let someone go across that line. But they're coming at us from all angles. They want to criminalize homeschooling. They want to start giving us government money so they can suck us back into the system we just fled from. So folks, watch out. Right now is a great time to homeschool. Pull your children out of the burning building right now. Cut your ties with the government. I mean, obviously, I recommend that people follow state laws as best they can on these issues. You don't want to get in unnecessary trouble. But if it comes down to it and they say, hand your children over, the answer's got to be no. If I've got to go to another country, if I got to go underground, it's not happening. They're not having my children. Period. End of discussion.
Yeah. Yeah. We've got homeschoolers here not too far from where we live in Tennessee who were political refugees out of Germany because they wouldn't let them homeschool. They would take their kids away from them. And they've been here for over a decade. And now the Biden administration tried to deport them a couple of months ago. Then they gave up after there was a lot of publicity about it. But that's the heart of our current federal government. They are in alignment with these Germans who want to take the kids away from people. That's where we are. So we're not that far away from it. It's important for people to understand the foundation of this. And again, you can find the book at your website, right? LibertySentinel.org. And tell us again the title of the book. I've got it here, but it's a couple pages over. Go ahead.
So it's Indoctrinating Our Children to Death, Government Schools War on Faith, Family, and Freedom, and How to Stop It. You can get it anywhere good books are sold. If you want a signed copy and you don't mind waiting a couple weeks and paying shipping, you can get it from my website, libertysentinel.org/shop.
Good. And do that instead of giving the money to Amazon. Thank you so much, Alex. And let me say thank you to the people here. Wayne Wonder, thank you very much for the birthday gift and tip. And also Owen, thank you very much. Appreciate that. Thank you all. Have a good day, everybody.
Let me tell you, the David Knight Show, you can listen to with your ears. You can even watch it by using your eyes. In fact, if you can hear me, that means you're listening to the David Knight Show right now. Yeah, good job. And you want to know something else? You can find all the links to everywhere to watch or listen to the show at thedavidknightshow.com. That's a website.